Critics say the Green New Deal is a radical way to reorganize the economy and address climate change. Its supporters say, yeah, they know.
It sounds crazy. I know, like, I understand. It sounds like a progressive wish list, but I genuinely think it's what we need.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, making the Green New Deal's case to lawmakers. And enforcements of environmental laws are down at the Environmental Protection Agency.
It appears to reflect the administration's priority that they are trying to work more collaboratively with companies.
Plus, a decline in insect populations is making headlines and worrying scientists.
If you were to remove the insects, the ecosystem that we know, particularly here in eastern North America, for instance, would collapse.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Allegheny County officials are requiring U.S. Steel to clean up emissions from several of its Pittsburgh area facilities. The county health department issued an enforcement order Thursday, 2 months after fire damaged pollution controls at U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works. Jim Kelly is with the health department. He says sulfur dioxide emissions from the company's plants far exceed what's allowed under their permits. Sulfur dioxide can aggravate respiratory problems.
It's one thing when you have a limit and you're barely above it. But when, you know, say the total limit for this facility is about 13,000 pounds of SO2 a day, and they're emitting over 70,000 pounds of SO2 a day, that's going to be a problem.
U.S. Steel has 5 days to respond with a plan. If it doesn't come into compliance, the health department says it will require the company to idle all of its batteries. U.S. Steel says it's reviewing the order and has made significant progress on repairs since the fire. And in other environmental news, a Washington County woman who sued natural gas companies over alleged pollution near her home testified recently before an investigative grand jury called by Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports Shapiro is looking into whether environmental crimes were committed during the state's fracking boom.
Stephanie Halowich settled her lawsuit with Range Resources and two other companies in 2011. The suit claimed the companies contaminated her groundwater and the air near her home in Mount Pleasant. Halowich's attorney, Peter Villari, said she recently received a subpoena to testify before the attorney general's grand jury. He said she didn't know what the grand jury was investigating, but asked his advice given that her settlement included a non-disclosure agreement.
And she was concerned that perhaps the subpoena related to information in that civil action. That civil action was settled and had a confidentiality clause that required that all defendants in that case be notified if she was ever subpoenaed.
Villari said none of the defendants objected to her testimony.
I told her to answer whatever questions they asked honestly and forthrightly, as is her obligation when subpoenaed.
In a letter obtained by the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania, Shapiro's office asked attorneys in a different pollution lawsuit involving Range Resources to preserve documents and evidence in their case. The August 2018 letter said the office was investigating, quote, environmental crimes in Washington County. A Shapiro spokesman said he could neither confirm nor deny the existence of an investigation. Officials from Range Resources did not respond to requests for comment. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Sometimes to find out what's going on with living insects, you have to visit some of the dead ones. Specimens, to be more precise. Vanessa Verdesia is the collection assistant here in the Invertebrate Zoology Department at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh. She's showing me a wooden drawer displaying 13 black and yellow butterflies.
This is Papilio homeris, so that's the genus and species name, and it's a pretty well-known butterfly. It's the largest butterfly in the Western Hemisphere.
The wingspan is 4 or 5 inches, and the butterfly is endemic to Jamaica, where populations there are declining on parts of the island.
So it's kind of iconic, and it's an interesting species to work on, figure out what's going on.
Verdesia contributed images of specimens from this collection to a recently published paper to get more research started into why these butterflies are disappearing. Because scientists around the world are reporting declines in insect populations. According to a recent study, 3/4 of flying insects in nature reserves across Germany have disappeared over the last 25 years. And scientists studying Puerto Rico have reported astonishing losses of insects on the ground, a reported 98% loss over 35 years. John Wenzel is a career entomologist and director of Powder Mill Nature Reserve, which is part of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. He and I sat down at the museum to talk about what's happening.
There have been some pretty alarming headlines recently about insect population decline all over the world and the threat of mass extinction. Is the situation as dire as these stories suggest?
I don't think we can really say that yet. Some of the situations really are terrible crisis. Other ones we're just discovering. We don't really know how bad they are. The research needs to be compared to something else. Do it again 2 years from now, that kind of a thing. Also, when we talk about loss, there are two kinds of loss. There's a loss where the species disappears completely, and then there's a loss where they're just not as frequent as they were. And both of those are important to measuring this crisis.
So these stories are not necessarily telling the full picture of what's happening.
Right. It certainly is more complicated than any of the sort of simple cries to arms make it out to be. The two studies you mentioned, I think, are important for very different reasons. In the German study, what they found was even within protected nature reserves, there's this collapse. What this means is our nature reserves aren't working. And apparently the human environment around the margin of the reserve is enough to degrade the preserved area so it isn't functioning properly anymore. That should be a great concern. The study from Puerto Rico is rather different. We don't think that that one's due to man-made influences around the island of Puerto Rico. Rather, that seems to be the result of climate change, where the rainy and dry seasons have changed a little bit. These forest insects that like wet forests, they're disappearing because the wet forest is drying out. So you have both man-made causes and natural causes, and of course these conspire in some places to create really a very grave situation where the insects and the plants they rely on, all kinds of other things, can't really live the way they used to live.
You mentioned we need more information. So where are the places, or what kind of data do we have, and what's needed?
Well, obviously, the best data are from places where people have been paying attention for a long time. So that's mostly Northern Europe and Eastern North America is where we usually have the best records. England and the British Isles generally have the best records, and they can be known almost to completion. So we often turn there for the best information. But going forward, there are several things that we want to do to generate good information. One is to do new research on what the change in population or impact is. So, for example, here at the Carnegie Museum, we recently got a grant to study chimney swifts, which are fast-flying nocturnal birds that eat mosquitoes and other small insects at night. And so we want to take the feces of chimney swifts and evaluate what they're actually eating. And you can do that over agricultural fields or urban areas or forested areas. And presumably we can see the change in insect fauna in that fashion and predict what the effects would be on these other animals that rely on insects. Another one is to restore them. And in some places in Europe, in Britain again, they've had really good results in restoring habitat or bringing back populations of things that were rare. And in doing that, you learn what is causing the trouble, and then you can undo it to try to help out. And again, here at the Carnegie Museum, we've been working jointly with the National Park Service at the Flight 93 Memorial, and we've been trying to restore what was a strip mine to a healthy pollinator habitat to recover, really, the bees and butterflies and flies and things that would be out in a natural or nature-like environment that's healthy.
We've mentioned climate change. You mentioned industry. What do we know about why population declines are happening in different regions?
Different regions, of course, have different causes of decline. For a lot of them, I think we casually like to blame insecticides, for instance, and sometimes that must be true, that the insecticides have had a tremendous impact. Certainly the intensification of agriculture, where we are spraying herbicides and insecticides all over the place, that will have a very grave impact on nearby natural areas that are downstream or downwind. But for the European studies, I think it's clear that it's some kind of a chronic effect of human activities, turning things into agriculture or urban environment or building highways or straightening the rivers or all those things that we do. Somehow that changes the environment, and all of those changes together often have a much greater effect than any individual little change. One of the things that's been observed, particularly in Britain, is the abandonment of the family farm seems to have an effect, and we can probably measure this in Eastern North America too. Family farms are actually pretty good places sometimes for wildlife because the edge of the field provides a place for weeds and little places for animals to live, and they often have water all year round. And so little family farms are not such a bad way to generate marginal, by which I mean a margin for animals and plants to live in. And now we've done away with those and we have gigantic monoculture that's industrial. That's a very different landscape. And so a lot of these changes are probably catching up with us all at once.
Can you just say a little more about the impact of insects on ecosystem, what roles insects play, and how that loss might be felt?
Yeah, once in a while people will say to me something like, oh, I heard somehow that insects will inherit the world. Will that be true? And I say, not really, because it's already theirs. The entire terrestrial ecosystem relies ultimately on plants, fundamentally, and then the next step is insects. The insects either pollinate the plants or control the weeds, or they simply feed on these leaves, and then a bird eats the insect that eats the leaves. And so if you were to remove the insects, the ecosystem that we know, particularly here in Eastern North America, for instance, that ecosystem would collapse in a year or two. The entire thing would be very unlike what we know today, because the insects are fundamental in regulating many of these processes or being the critical link in the food chain between plants and higher animals. Leaves would fall to the ground and they wouldn't turn into soil anymore. They'd just be dead leaves on the ground. Everything that you think of would be disrupted.
Do you think dramatic headlines that we've seen recently, do you think they're harmful, or do you think they get people interested?
Well, I don't think those are alternatives. I think they are a little harmful and they get people interested. When you consider how people view changes in the natural environment, people are always alarmed by that. Any change seems to be dramatic and dangerous. So sometimes I think that the dramatic headlines are undeserved. But this is something that we're still just figuring out, and every time we measure it, it seems to look worse than we thought. So I think maybe the dramatic headlines here, maybe they really are called for, but it's important to state that we haven't quite figured this out yet. Also, truthfully, if it is very different reasons, then we're sounding the alarm and we're trying to point to a single cause. If there are many, many causes, then we need to write many articles with scary headlines instead of just one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kara.
John Wenzel is director of Powder Mill Nature Reserve, which is part of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. For more stories in our Wild PA series about wildlife and conservation, head to our website at alleghenyfront.org/wildpa. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Inspections of industrial facilities by the Environmental Protection Agency are down from 2010. There are fewer people on staff to do them, and that's partly because Congress hasn't been generous with funding.
But this appears to be a trend that's accelerated under the Trump administration.
Later on The Allegheny Front, what happens when the environmental cops aren't on the beat? Stay tuned. Toledo residents who approved something called an Environmental Bill of Rights for Lake Erie didn't have long to celebrate a special election victory on Tuesday. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that farmers are fighting back, saying the new law violates their rights.
When Toledo residents were told not to use their tap water for 3 days in August 2014, Julie and Mac couldn't believe it.
It was like a scary movie.
They were told not to use it for drinking or cooking.
It was a struggle. At that point in time, they were telling us not to use the water to even bathe.
A toxin from algae had poisoned the city's water distribution system. Mac remembers the FEMA trucks with water stationed at local schools. His own family drove more than 2 hours to get cases of water.
It became very obvious at that point in time how important water is to our everyday life.
Mac, a community activist, has since been part of a movement in Toledo to protect the water. They created the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, a city charter amendment giving the lake legal rights that citizens would be able to defend in court. After years of legal wrangling, they finally got it on the ballot in a special election and won with 61% of the vote.
It was unbelievable. It was an unbelievable feeling.
But Joe Corneli points out that only 9% of registered voters actually cast ballots. He's spokesperson for the Ohio Farm Bureau, which opposed the measure.
Well, obviously, we were disappointed.
Runoff from fertilizer and manure from farms has been blamed for feeding the toxic blooms. Corneli says Ohio has created two new laws since the 2014 algae crisis to control this problem. But it's not a simple fix.
Trying to solve complex problems at the ballot box is not the right way to do this.
The Lake Erie Bill of Rights grants new powers for Toledo residents to hold businesses and the government accountable for polluting the lake.
Virtually any citizen of Toledo can claim that a farmer in any of 35 Ohio counties is doing damage to the lake and then take them to court.
Mari Margill is spokesperson for a nonprofit law firm, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. It helped concerned Toledo citizens develop the Bill of Rights. She says they couldn't get the government and farmers to move faster to protect the water, so they moved to imbue the lake itself with rights.
One of the things that this has done is really brought this concept of really changing how nature is treated under the law and the need to do that in order to protect it.
Communities around the world have started approving rights of nature laws to protect the environment. A similar bill in Grant Township, Pennsylvania, is currently being litigated. The Lake Erie bill brought swift legal action from an Ohio farmer whose attorney calls the Toledo Amendment an unlawful assault on family farms. Margill says supporters expected this and will be deciding how to respond. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
The Green New Deal is an ambitious proposal to tackle climate change. Since its introduction to Congress by Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey, the plan has been both mocked and praised for its boldness. So far, just 89 representatives in the House and 11 senators have signed on as co-sponsors. A group of young activists is determined to change that. WHYY's Catalina Jaramillo reports.
Abigail Leedy is a senior at Central High School, but on this day, she skipped class to meet with staffers from Democratic Congressman Dwight Evans' office in North Philadelphia.
We have about 15 people here today because we want Dwight Evans to co-sponsor this resolution now and to get his support out now.
Leedy's with a nationwide group led by young activists called the Sunrise Movement. They spearheaded the Green New Deal, gaining the support of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The goal of the plan is to achieve carbon neutral emissions and transition to 100% clean energy in only 10 years. That's 20 years earlier than goals set by progressive cities around the country. Republicans have called the Green New Deal a socialist fantasy. President Donald Trump made fun of it recently in Texas.
It would shut down a little thing called air travel.
Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso said people will also have to give up ice cream because to meet the goals of the deal, cows would have to be eliminated.
Say goodbye to dairy, to beef, to family farms, to ranches. American favorites like cheeseburgers and a milkshake will become a thing of the past.
Cow flatulence, farts, and burps include the powerful greenhouse gas methane. The EPA says agriculture overall contributes 9% of the nation's carbon emissions. And because of an early mention of cows in the Green New Deal, the beef and cattle industry started actively lobbying against the program. Activists are aware that to reach the deal's goals, radical change is needed. But Leedy says that's what the times are calling for.
It sounds crazy. I know, like I understand it sounds like a progressive wish list, but I genuinely think it's what we need if we are going to avert complete catastrophe.
Last year, a United Nations science report said that if we don't cut emissions drastically within 12 years, the results would be catastrophic, including floods, drought, and extreme heat. Liddy says she's already feeling the effects of climate change. Last summer, excessive heat caused 5 early dismissals for Philadelphia public schools.
I think that every year that is going to get worse.
Critics of the Green New Deal say there's no specifics and it's too ambitious. Associate Professor of Government at Franklin and Marshall College, Biko Koenig, says that's how political action often happens.
Part of the work of social movement actors is to redefine what is possible. So 3 weeks ago, we weren't having a conversation about the Green New Deal, and now we are.
He points to other successful movements led by young people, like the opposition to the Vietnam War, or more recently, Black Lives Matter. Democratic Representative Brenda Boyle from Northeast Philadelphia is the only member of Pennsylvania's delegation co-sponsoring the Green New Deal.
Probably the best thing that talk of the Green New Deal has done is actually put climate change part of the conversation, which was not happening.
Boyle is hopeful the newly formed Select Committee on Climate Crisis will actually craft legislation to tackle climate change.
Right now, the federal government of the United States of America has zero plans on the books to address climate change that is already happening. That is the frightening prospect.
Ultimately, the Sunrise Movement wants to make climate change a major issue in the upcoming 2020 presidential race. Sophia Seya is the group's Pennsylvania state director.
Politicians are just going to find out that they either are going to have to stand with us and protect our futures and support the Green New Deal, or they are going to be voted out.
For State Impact, I'm Catalina Jaramillo.
What happens when environmental laws and rules aren't enforced? Democratic lawmakers are concerned about new numbers from the US EPA. Data show significant drops in agency inspections, penalties, and criminal cases referred to the Department of Justice. Susan Bodine, Assistant Administrator of Enforcement and Compliance at EPA, defended the agency at a recent House committee hearing.
A strong enforcement program does not mean that we have to collect a particular dollar amount of penalties or take a particular number of formal actions.
So what does all of this mean? For our podcast, Trump on Earth, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke with Juliette Eilperin. She covers national affairs for The Washington Post and has been covering these issues.
So let's maybe start with some definitions, I guess. When we hear about inspections and evaluations, it might sound obvious, but what are we talking about? What does EPA inspect and what kinds of things are they looking for?
This can be anything from oil and gas operations, drilling, flaring, things like that, as well as, you know, a chemical plant, just a slew of industrial activities across the country where you could have potential violations of some of our landmark environmental laws, things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. They're essentially looking for operations where companies are not complying with the law and as a result could be making our air and our water dirtier.
So as you've reported, there's been a sharp drop in inspections under the Trump administration. Do we know why and what are the implications of fewer inspections?
It's a little hard to know why, because as you might imagine, EPA officials were not particularly forthcoming with, you know, information about what accounts for some of these trends. They did confirm the numbers. But as a result, you know, there's kind of a different story on the criminal side and the civil side of enforcement, and we can get into that. But on the civil side, it appears to reflect the administration's priority that they are trying to work more collaboratively with companies, and they have even changed the names of titles of programs to try to say that this is really about compliance rather than enforcement, and that they would rather work with companies and try to fix things initially than crack down on them for violating the law.
But don't they still need inspections in order to get compliance?
They do. And in fact, Even EPA's own website talks about the importance of inspections as a key element in enforcement and ensuring that companies are meeting their legal requirements. So it's clear, you know, we're talking about this is a significant drop to roughly 10,600 inspections across the country, which is only half the number that EPA conducted at its peak in 2010. There's a broader trend, which to some extent reflects just Congress has been less generous to EPA in recent years, and so it does have fewer staffers. But this appears to be a trend that's accelerated under the Trump administration, so it's more than just staffing changes.
Does this mean that I imagine there are folks out there who would say, we're just not going to catch as many people there. I mean, we're not going to catch as many problems if we don't have, you know, eyes out there looking.
Right. So that is really what folks would say. They'd say they're not the same cops on the beat. Also, you know, there were lots of interesting numbers that came out in these data. And one of the things is that they're also not initiating as many cases and kind of opening up cases and investigations, and they're not completing as many cases. And so that's significant, too. That's all part of this trend.
Okay, can we talk about the difference between civil penalties and criminal charges, intentional wrongdoing?
So criminal charges reflect, for example, when you're saying there's intentional wrongdoing. So one incident that listeners might be familiar with is when there was a terrible coal ash spill in North Carolina on the Dan River several years ago.
3 weeks ago, a pipe that runs under a coal ash pond collapsed at a plant owned by Duke Energy Company. Coal ash is the waste produced.
What EPA was able to discover is that there had been folks within Duke Energy who had been warning that pipes were corroding and that they needed to be replaced or fixed in order to avert a disaster. That's criminal negligence. Those are the kinds of cases that aren't going to be done by the states. They're expensive. They take tremendous resources. And it really usually is the federal government that brings those kinds of cases.
And I wonder if sort of something that's more potentially widespread is the civil penalties, you know, getting out to so many different facilities to check for violations.
We started to try to investigate this, and I think it will just take more time. You have to file Freedom of Information Act requests to figure out where they've issued notices of violation. So in other words, we can kind of demand public records that would say, here's an operation where they're putting too much lead into the air, or here's a chemical plant where they're potentially emitting, you know, some sort of toxic chemical. Then the issue is you really have to go to the company and see if they will say whether they've responded to EPA's notice of violation or not. The agency itself doesn't discuss pending cases. So it's difficult to pinpoint this is a place which is certainly continuing to violate public health safeguards, you know, after being notified. So in terms of identifying places where EPA hasn't gone, it really, in some extent, would be a needle in a haystack. So while I absolutely think that's a great reporting target, it will take time to figure out what's the most effective way to pin that down.
Juliet Eilperin is a reporter for The Washington Post who covers national affairs. She spoke with the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant about EPA enforcement under the Trump administration for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more at trumponearth.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.